Hey you, and welcome. My name is Mike, and in this old podcast, well, it's a twofer, folks. Yeah, I have to say, I really like telling two stories in one podcast. That has like a certain kind of momentum to it. And this story, this episode I have for you is preliminarily called, or maybe finally called, like the theme of this one is, really? That's why they did this? Really? I'm calling it that because the motives in these two cases are, weird. Odd. Not the usual life insurance dance ones, my favorite. Well, okay, maybe just a little bit of that. Or not because someone was having an affair. Actually, wait, no, scratch that, there's a little bit of that too. But no, it's not just that. The motives in these cases are weirder than just that. But in these cases, besides the motives, the crimes themselves, messed up, gruesome. Especially the second one. Now, the first story I'm going to tell you, it's less gruesome than the second, but way more horrific. So you got horrifying and gruesome. Look forward to that. So please, my friends, before we get into it, follow, subscribe, rate and review the podcast. It helps out incredibly. I promise if you do, I will immediately start walking towards you like that movie It Follows so I can give you a nice big hug. Or maybe just a audible thank you. Thank you. Now, let's give it a go. So let's begin with story number one, mainly because it comes before two. Now this whole case really began on the waters off Newport Beach, California, on a boat called the Well Deserved, a 55-foot yacht owned by one Tom and Jackie Hawks. They were living their best life, as people say. Do people still say that? But when they decided they wanted to sell their boat and move to Arizona to be closer to their newly born grandson, once Skylar De Leon arrived, inquiring about taking the boat off their hands, I'll buy it off you. And things took a turn from there. Now, Tom Hawks, he grew up in California. He was a military veteran, a former probation officer. He married, and together with his first wife, he had two boys. Now, they would eventually divorce, and he would raise the two boys by himself. He would later marry Jackie, and she quickly became a close mother to Tom's sons. Tom and Jackie, they were both hard workers, they scrimped and they saved, and in their 50s, the couple, Tom and Jackie, were able to retire, which is pretty sweet deal. In November 2000, Tom and Jackie paid $300,000 for a 55-foot yacht, the well-deserved, aptly named for this hard-working, loving couple. By the way, that's just so goddamn much money. Like, I wonder if the resale value, though, like $300,000 is a lot of money. I can't imagine the resale value would be. Look at me. I'm talking about investments. I'm getting old. They would spend so much time on this boat they loved. They lived on it. Traveling, you know, Newport Beach up and down the coast of California, like into Mexico. They lived this life for 2 years. That was until they heard the news their first grandchild was en route, ETA, 9 months. Tom, he was simply overjoyed to hear about the arrival of the little one, as was Jackie, who, you know, she had been in a motorcycle accident at a young age, and that left her unable to have children of her own. And so, with the arrival of their first grandchild, Tom and Jackie, with like zero hesitation, they were like, yep. All right, we are done with this bullshit. Enough of that sailing, all that bullshit. We're gonna full-time granny and granddad.
Jackie's coming today. Got the boat all cleaned up. And I think I'm gonna take a shower after I work out and shave my beard. Not a bad beard for 15 days, huh? Ah. So waiting to see her. This is Captain Tom Hawks and well-deserved.
Hi, honey. I'm so glad to be home.
She's home.
Man, this is scary.
I'm going to go play some more.
Okay. Be careful, honey.
There is a lot of home video of the mustachioed Tom and Jackie, and honestly, they seem just like the sweetest, kindest, most lovely people. Like this story, the story I'm telling you right now, I told on the YouTube channel. I told it a couple of years back. I remember telling this story vividly, though, because I just remember Tom and Jackie seemed like the people you would want to be your own grandparents. Lovely people, and they just seemed like a lot of fun. They would have been amazing grandparents. And so, Tom and Jackie, they took out an ad in a boating magazine, Yachting World, to sell the well-deserved asking for $435,000, which is a... Guys, that's a nice little profit there. I wouldn't have thought the resale value would be that high, but maybe they put a lot of work into it, you know? Look at me talking about investment properties. I mean, I wouldn't have gone for boats, but... Hey, all I know is buy high, sell low. Okay, well, maybe that's not how you're supposed to do it, but it sure as shit keeps happening to me. Tom and Jackie went on their final boating trip in November 2004 to Catalina Island. They had sold the boat at this stage. Well, the sale was going to go true within the next few days. They'd sold the boat to a child actor nonetheless. Ooh, this is California after all. So it was all going well until no one could get a hold of them anymore. Their sons, they couldn't get through to them when they called. And Tom and Jackie would always, you know, be in contact to ask about their grandson. So when they stopped, it was disconcerting, to say the least. Tom's brother, Jim Hawks, he lived in San Diego and he used to be the chief of police there. So he, you know, being, you know, a couple of hours drive away, he went up to Newport Beach to see what he could see. Jim Hawks arrived at Newport Beach and he found the boat. He found the well-deserved, but zero sign of Tom or Jackie Hawks and no sign of their car. The dinghy they used to go from the dock to the well-deserved, that was there. But oddly enough, he noticed a couple of strange things. Tom and Jackie, very experienced boat operators, but the dinghy wasn't tied properly to the dock. And when he went over to the boat, to the well-deserved, things were just, off. Bits and pieces, you know, not tied down properly, or not using the correct knots. A towel hanging just out of the window, there was a general offness about it. Like, the Hawks took care of their boat, and this was not how they kept it. But there was no sign of Tom or Jackie as the days went on. So, asking around, well, you know, anyone and everyone, it turned out that the last time anyone heard from Tom and Jackie was when they went out to sea with the new buyers of the well-deserved. The buyers, you know, they wanted to take the boat out for a test sale. After that, they were never heard from again. That had been on November 15th, 2004. Okay, so who then was this prospective buyer? So, what Jim Hawks did was he left a note on the well-deserved, essentially saying, "I'm a retired police officer. I would like to speak with whomever bought the boat. Tom and Jackie are missing." Not long after, Jim was contacted by a woman named Jennifer DeLeon. She told Jim, "Yep, me and my husband, we bought that boat. My husband, Skyler, we paid in cash and in full. Yeah, we're also looking for Tom and Jackie. We need the instruction manual for the boat. We don't have, how does this shit work?" But the De Leons, they said that after they bought the boat, Tom and Jackie, they drove off, never heard from them again. They just left us with this boat and no idea how to use it. They did say something about Mexico, though, vaguely, but I don't know. But investigating further, there had been no activity in the Hawks bank account. The De Leons said they had given them $435,000, so that's a hell of a lot of money to be just carrying around with you in cash. And so, on November 26th, 2004, missing persons reports were filed for both Tom and Jackie. And so, the police started looking into Skyler and Jennifer De Leon. 25-year-old Skyler, it turned out, had a criminal record, having been in the Salama for armed burglary. He was on probation at the time. Now, Skyler was born John Julius Jacobson, his father, a drug dealer. He had been a child actor, So it seems like his dad just wanted him to act, essentially was pimping him out as a child actor to make some scarole, some dollar bills off of him. Skylar's biggest claim to fame was being an extra in Power Rangers, so wow, look at you. Skylar later joined the Marines. He got into Force Recon Marine. Holy shit, watch out, you guys. And he claimed to have over 60 confirmed kills. After he got out, he changed his name to Skylar De Leon. As it turns out, that's exactly what it sounds like. A lie. He never joined Force Recon, and he was out of the Marines within a couple of weeks. He couldn't hack it. So shortly after, he met Jennifer Henderson online, and they done married. He had one kid with another on the way. Jennifer was pregnant, but they were deep in the shit, money-wise. $90,000 in debt, living in Jennifer's parents' garage. So, with all that going on, it's kind of interesting they would purchase a 55-foot yacht for over $400,000 in cash. No diggity, like, what? How are you? You're in debt. What the shit? Detectives went out to the well-deserved. They started taking pictures of it as evidence, and there they found a receipt on the boat. On the receipt was some interesting purchases, namely bin bags, bleach, and Tums, in case someone had an uppity tummy after using, bleach and bin bags, or probably if somebody had an uppity tummy being out on the water. So the police, they had this receipt from Target, and they went to the store where these items were purchased to see who bought all this shit. Was it the Leons, or was it the Hawks who bought them? Turned out it was someone else. So was there another person on that boat? Well, it turned out who bought them was Steve Henderson, Jennifer's dad. The police paid him a visit and also went to see Skylar and Jennifer. And Steve said he bought these items for Skylar and for Jennifer. And so police, they got from the De Leons what appeared to the police to be perfectly legal notarized documents of the sale of the boat. Like, everything looked legit, even though there was obviously many questions about how the De Leons were able to afford it. The sale, like, was notarized. It looked legit. It looked official. Everything was perfectly fine and dandy, except how did they afford it? Where did they get the money from? And still, Tom and Jackie disappeared. So, Skylar says, well, hey, I got the money. It's money I stole from the armed robbery that I went to prison for, and I'm now on probation for. Which is illegal, so he basically just admitted to money laundering. Obviously this raised a few eyebrows, but he sticks to that story. You know, I gave the Hawks the money, they drove off, never saw them again or heard from them again. I got this money that's mine in a perfectly illegal way, so leave me alone, it's notarized, you guys. And the police, they found one more thing. Documents indicating that the Hawks had given Skylar De Leon power of attorney, aka complete control of all their assets. And they had footage of Skylar and Jennifer trying to withdraw money from the Hawks' account. Weird. Very freaking weird. Like, was this part of the sale too? Hey, buy my boat. And, you know, while you're at it, take control of my entire life. Deal. Skylar's explanation, though, for why he had power of attorney over these two grandparents who were supposed to be moving out of state... Well, his explanation was that they were going to buy a house in Mexico. And to do that, you need someone like me, a criminal you just met. It's a complicated process, you know. It's hard to explain all the ins and outs, so I'll just do it for you. The one thing was strange on the power of attorney document, which again was notarized. Jackie spelled her name Hawk. Not Hawks. And then it seemed like someone else had added the S. Like, it was different. The S was written at the end in someone else's handwriting. Did Jackie forget her own surname? On the bill of sale documents was also the name Alonzo Machane as a witness. Who's Alonzo? Skylar said he was a friend from Mexico. So wow. The Hawks not only gave their entire life away, the power of attorney, to a criminal fucking stranger, they also got someone to witness it they didn't even know or trust. Alonzo was someone Skylar happened to meet in prison, though he was a prison guard, not, like, in prison. The police spoke to him, and he told the exact same story. They spoke to the notary who signed the papers, and the notary said, yep, everything was hunky-dory, legit, I saw it all go down, the Hawks, they signed off, and they fucked off. So, with jack shit to go on, the police, you know, and everybody was sticking to the same story, the police finally turned to the media's help. They started public pleas for attention, you know, for anybody see something, please say something. And it worked. Guess what? Their car, the Hawks' car that had been missing, you know, the car, information on the car was put out, and someone had eyeballed it. But all the way down all Mexico way. So maybe Skylar was being honest, like maybe the Hawks really had given their entire life away to some strangers and left to go to Mexico, which was completely out of character for them. So the police, they went all down there thinking, okay, this is weird as shit, but maybe it's legit as shit. Maybe they did go to Mexico. So they arrived, they saw the Hawks' car, they knockety-knocked on the door of the house, the car was parked outside, and who opened the door? Not the Hawks, because of course the Hawks didn't open the door. Out comes a guy, and says a fella named Skylar De Leon gave him that car, and Skylar's DNA was also found in the car. This was the final piece of the puzzle, one that pretty clearly painted the picture that Skylar, and possibly others, murdered the Hawks. When the police got back to California, they arrested Skylar. They searched the De Leon's apartment, and they found the Hawks' video camera with their footage still on it, their laptop, and a police officer's card, like a detective's card, which led them to another unsolved case. The case of John Jarvie. Let me just spin away from the Hawks for a moment. John Jarvie was someone Skylar had met in prison. John Jarvie was found with his throat cut in Mexico a year before the Hawks disappeared. What happened was that Skylar told this John Jarvie, yeah, hey man, I got a sweet investment in Mexico. Bring 50K with you and I'll meet you down there. You're going to be a millionaire. I got a pretty sweet deal going on. How do you think that ended? Skylar actually did this while on day release from jail for armed robbery. So what a guy. He gets, you know, like the one day out from jail and he slits somebody's throat. What a guy. Actually, sorry, that's actually the wrong term to use, I know, but we'll get to that. So the police, they went back. They went back through all the case, and they re-interviewed who they thought of as probably the most trustworthy, believable person in the case, right? The notary, who notarized the power of attorney and bill of sale documents. It was her job, like she's legally has to do this, it was her ass on the line. She better be telling the truth about what she saw. And she was like, yeah, I saw them doing the Hawks and the De Leons. It was legit. She would not change her story until she did. She finally told the police that she didn't witness the Hawks sign anything. The forms, they were brought to her pre-signed, and she was paid in cash by Skylar to notarize the documents. Next, the police went to Alonzo Machane, who was the witness on those documents. And the beans done spilled. It was a very disturbing story, Alonzo told.
I'm asking you, if at all possible, to just be as honest as you possibly can be. It would help us get the puzzle together and know the truth.
Skylar approaches me with this plan he has. He was going to do something that, you know, was going to make some money. So he offers me to help. The plan is that we were supposed to basically kidnap them and take them out to sea and toss them overboard.
See, when Skylar and Alonzo first arrived at the well-deserved under the pretense of purchasing it from the Hawks, Tom, he was very suspicious. Two young guys, something off about them. Like, how could they afford this? $430,000, right? So what Skylar did then, he called his pregnant wife, Jennifer, and he got her to come down to the dock with the kid, and she, as I said, she had a baby bump. So Skylar was like, hey, well, come on, here's my wife and my kid. I'm a family man. You can trust me, right? But Tom was a big big, strong guy. Skyler and Alonso, they were not. And even though Tom, he was getting on in years, he could have taken them both. So Skyler, sizing Tom up, seeing this might be difficult, Skyler called up another friend, a friend I haven't mentioned yet, JFK. Yeah. He dug him up. Another guy, but also John Fitzgerald Kennedy. This John Fitzgerald Kennedy, how dare he, by the way? He was a local gangster. And again, Skyler knew him from prison. If nothing else, Skyler was able to make connections while in the can. So, they all headed off to test the boat, sailing out to Catalina Island. But Jennifer and the baby stayed at the dock. So on the boat was Tom, Jackie, Skyler, Alonzo, and JFK. They headed out from Newport Harbor towards Catalina. Out on the ocean, they overpowered the Hawks. They tied them up and forced them to sign the power of attorney documents and bill of sale documents. Remember how Jackie signed her name Hawk, not Hawks? She deliberately did that to try and show that something was wrong.
This is actually where they bring them up one at a time to do all the paperwork signing. Skyler sits his skinny ass right down here and is typing in all their info. And we've got the time that he's inputting all that stuff on the forensic on the computer, so we can know what time they're alive still. And Larry, this is the bed where Tom's overpowered down here, and then Jackie and Tom are put on the bed here and restrained. They're duct taped, handcuffed, and put on the bed. And this is when you hear the part about Tom stroking her hand. It occurs down here to put her at ease. I don't like being down here.
Then, honestly, it is horrifying. Skyler handcuffed Tom and Jackie to an anchor and set course for a much deeper part of the ocean. Skyler then threw the anchor overboard. Tom and Jackie Hawks were still alive when they were dragged by the anchor off the boat and deep into the cold, dark ocean to die.
I don't even like being on this boat. It's, yeah, you know, I feel like I'm still invading their home.
Yeah.
This is still fine. Imagine. And the worst part is they were downstairs for several hours knowing they knew they were going to die. At least Tom Hawks did, I'm pretty sure. And this is where they're secured and tied up. And Alonzo's telling us is that Thomas Hawks and Jackie Hawks are here. Thomas Hawks' belly's for her back. They're tied up, handcuffed. I'm assuming they brought the anchor back this way. He mule kicks Skyler here, and JFK is somewhere in this area where he punches Thomas Hawk. Now, Alonzo says that he goes limp as if he went unconscious or at least stunned. She being Jackie, is screaming through her tape, you know, through the tape now, because now she's supporting her husband's weight, doesn't know what's going on. It's underway, the boat's underway, it's cold, it's at nighttime. And as soon as JFK hits them and they fall, Skyler gets back up, picks up the anchor, walks right here and tosses it right out, and it's feeding the line that they've tied to them. And they're knocked down because JFK had hit them, pushed them down, and then they get vine feeds out and just throws them right out. And apparently she strikes, from what his description, very hard on this quarter right here.
So mercifully, maybe she was...
You know what, once again, I try to sanitize it and think, please, you know, that both of them were unconscious. You hope that they didn't suffer more than they already had to.
All were arrested. Skyler and Jennifer pled not guilty throughout. They said they had nothing to do with this. That's not what happened. Until Jennifer changed her tune. She said she only went along with it because she feared Skyler might kill her too. She got life with parole. So that's what happened to the Hawks. So why did they... What was the motive to do this? Well, money, obviously. But the main one was the reason for the money. Skyler was transgender. It's believed that they did this so they could pay for gender reassignment surgery for Skyler. Even before what happened on The Well Deserved, Skyler had put down $500 for the gender reassignment surgery. One of the reasons they changed their name was that Skyler's a gender-neutral name, so they could use it when they were presenting as a man and when they were presenting as a woman. And then at one point, while in jail, Skyler was really desperate for that surgery because they attempted to do the job themselves. Skyler tied a sheet around their junk, got out a razor blade, and yikes. jeez. Okay. Every guy just crossed their legs. Yeah, squeamish. I mean, fair enough, you want to get the surgery. Bad idea to do it yourself. Really bad idea. In 2008, Skyler went on trial for the murder of three people, the Hawks and John Jarvie. By the way, at one point, while in jail, Skyler also did the old try to pay someone to get rid of witnesses in my upcoming trial, which came back to bite in the ass when this person testified against Skyler. Their trial ended with the death penalty for Skyler De Leon. Lethal injection. JFK also got the death penalty. Alonzo Machain got 20 years. Over the years since, Skyler and Jennifer divorced, and Skyler now identifies as a woman. She legally became a woman in 2019, and she hasn't given up on the gender reassignment surgery. She petitioned the state to pay for it, the state of California, but they denied, saying it was not, quote, medically necessary. Also, Skyler, she killed people to pay for it in an extremely dark and disturbing way. So, like, in prison, now trying to get the state to pay for it, it kind of just seems like cheating to me. Though that's a whole other debate, so I'm not going to wade into that. I'll leave that there. The tragic irony is that Tom and Jackie's lives ended on the well-deserved. And what happened to them was anything but. And you know, they're still classed as missing. Their bodies have never been recovered. Unlikely they ever will be. They're somewhere in the Pacific Ocean. It's hard to think of a worse way to go than that, but if it's any solace, at least they went together. Not really, to be honest. So, yeah. And that's that old story. That's the horrific one, by the way. Now, I've got another story, which is pretty gruesome, and will might just make you a little bit sick. So, look forward to that. On the early morning hours of November the 16th, 2012, in Willoughby Hills, Ohio, a 911 call was made. I'm only going to play a snippet of this 911 call because it's frankly quite disturbing. Like, I've listened to a lot of 911 calls. I've been doing true crime for about 6 years at this point, and this one, it's, yeah, no kidding.
911,
what happened to
get off the radio, Julia?
What's going on? Who had the night?
My sister and I just woke up because I was yelling. My 2518 Chagrin Drive. I have a female yelling on the phone. Someone else had the night.
In the house was 41-year-old Lisa Knoffel, 18-year-old Sabrina Zunich, her foster daughter, and Lisa's two biological children, 13-year-old Megan and 3-year-old Haley. The man of the house, Lisa's husband Kevin, he was a truck driver. He just happened to be out of town that night. The 911 call was made at 1:16 a.m. The caller was Lisa's 13-year-old daughter, Megan. And so, when the police arrived, Megan, she met them at the front door, absolutely frantic if that 911 call didn't give it away, telling the police that her foster sister Sabrina was stabbing her mother to death. The police entered the home, you know, guns drawn, flashlights out, and Sabrina wandered out of Lisa's bedroom, absolutely dripping in blood. And Sabrina immediately surrendered to the police, handing them a 15-inch knife. You couldn't get any more blood on it, let's say that. Miss Sabrina, when she was arrested, she didn't utter a single word. She was just crying. In the bedroom, they found Lisa Knoffel stabbed to shit. There were signs of a struggle. And also inside that same bedroom where this horrific murder had occurred was 3-year-old Haley sobbing inside the wardrobe. Lisa, she had been pretty badly killed, you know. Sabrina had stabbed her 12 times, cut her 178 times, severed her carotid artery, stabbed her in the lung, the eye, severed fingers. Brutal fatality. No shit. Understatement of the year. Gruesome. So, what the shit led to a foster daughter stabbing her foster mother brutally to death. Well, you know, my friends out there listening up, you know there's always a kicker in my stories. So, there's quite a kicker in this old one, so let's get to it. Sabrina lived with the Knuffles for a year and a half, as I said, their foster child. Sabrina was born in 1994. Now, both her parents, they suffered from health issues. Her dad, he died in 2012 from a drug overdose, and her mother had drug and alcohol issues. So Sabrina, she lived with her grandmother at quite a young age. However, when she was caught stealing money from her grandmother for drugs and alcohol, I mean, she learned from her parents, I guess, the court said her grandmother, you can't take care of her. And at 16, Sabrina Zunich entered the foster system, eventually ending up with the Knuffles. Lisa and Kevin Knuffle had been married for 6 years. Lisa, a social worker, Kevin, a truck driver. And always described as a loving couple. Friends describe them as, you know, the two people destined to be together from the moment they met. Wow, never heard of that one before. They married 1 year after they first met. Both had been married before, having children from previous marriages. Lisa's 13-year-old Megan, the one who called 911, she was from a previous marriage. But 3-year-old Haley was Lisa and Kevin's own. Lisa, though, she felt she had more love to give. And so, 2 years after Haley was born, 16-year-old Sabrina Zunich came to live with them. They welcomed a foster daughter who they thought could, you know, give more love to, help raise in a loving, you know, supportive environment. And so when Sabrina moved in, she fit in with the Knuffle family like a glove for a while. But as I told you, she would eventually end up murdering her foster mother who took her in very brutally. And for a time, for no apparent reason at all. So, to state the obvious, the who was pretty obvious. She was dripping in blood with a knife. Did give away. The why, though. Why Sabrina had done this. Okay, I mean, I get that, you know, she kind of came from a very messed up background, but stabbing someone brutally to death, it's a bit beyond. But that wouldn't come out for some time. Sabrina, she first told the police when she was brought in that she had just woken up in the middle of the night with a migraine. She went to the master bathroom to get some painkillers for her noodle, and then after she took the painkillers, oof, she blacked out, couldn't remember jack shit after that. Next thing she knew, she was a knife in her hand covered in blood. That'll get out of jail free card. Ooh, I don't remember what happened. Ooh, did I kill someone? Oh no. The police, they called bullshit on that one pretty quickly. But Sabrina, she called an attorney, and she wouldn't speak anymore. Sabrina kept her mouth shut for 9 months, not giving the police anything about why she had done what she had done. She just wasn't saying. But, well, it turned out that Sabrina was not alone in this. See, 9 months after the murder of his wife, Kevin Knuffle was arrested. Kevin was charged with conspiring with Sabrina to kill his wife. And this'll make you sick. He'd been having an affair with his foster daughter when she was 17 years old. It started 9 months after she moved in with the family. What? Like, jeez, what a creep. This guy fucking sucks. So how did the police know all this? Well, Sabrina told them. She decided to spill the beans on everything. I mean, really, because her guilt was getting to her. And also, you know, hefty. She was staring at a pretty hefty jail sentence. It turned out that Sabrina got along well with Kevin. Obviously a little too well, but not at all. Not at all with Lisa. And Lisa had become frustrated with how flirty Sabrina was with Kevin. And this then began to impact the Knuffles' marriage. Kevin giving Sabrina all the attention she wanted. Now, Sabrina, she came from a broken home. She had a rough upbringing. Remember, she stole from her grandmother for drugs and alcohol. So it's not surprising, you know, that she would want attention. But I guess this is not the right kind of attention, and Kevin Knafel was obviously a piece of shit who gave it to her. Banging your foster daughter? This is fucking disgusting. Messed up. Fucked is the word I'll use. In fact, less than a week before Lisa's death, Lisa started to just be like sick of how much attention he was giving her. She texted Kevin saying, "Cut the damn cord. Spending too much time with her and less time with your real family. Thanks a lot." Lisa was also uncomfortable with Sabrina's relationship with 3-year-old Haley. Like, Sabrina was acting like a mother towards her foster sister. Like, it seemed like Sabrina wanted to become the woman of the house. She was there to replace Lisa as wife and mother. Now, I gotta mention at this point, according to those who knew Lisa, she never once voiced suspicions of her husband and Sabrina that there was something, you know, sexual going on here. Just, you know, that's just something to say. But maybe the idea of it is just so messed up. Lisa never wanted to say it. Like, saying it out loud might be the, you know, "Oh balls, my husband is sleeping with our 17-year-old foster daughter." This is too messed up. Maybe, you know, saying it out loud might make it real, and she was hoping to avoid that. Sick shit. A few weeks before Lisa's murder, Sabrina was told to pack her shit and get the fuck out of the house. That didn't end well, as you are hearing. Sabrina told the police that Kevin had coerced her into doing it, though, that he too had grown to hate Lisa, and he told Sabrina he loved her. He promised her they'd be a happy little family once Lisa was out of the picture. Also, to the surprise of literally no one, including yourselves, it turned out Lisa had a big ol' life insurance policy of about $785,000. She had a few life insurance policies, something Kevin applied for hours after Lisa was pronounced dead. Sabrina said they'd been discussing offing Lisa for months. First, you know, talking about shooting her, then talking about hiring someone to kill her, hiring a hitman, we'll come back to that by the way, before finally, they finally settled on stabbing her to death in her sleep. To me, honestly, that seems to be the worst out of the three ideas they had. Kevin would also make sure he just so happened to be away working that night so he wouldn't be implicated, because he's a coward who manipulated a messed up kid into doing his dirty work. What a champ. They wanted to plan the murder to look like a break-in. You know, Sabrina was supposed to take some jewelry, make it look like a robbery, which is a very stupid idea. In the months that followed after the murder, but before Kevin was arrested, he started buying cars, campers, remodeling, spending. He was spending money like he had a hole in his pocket. He was starting fresh. Kevin was, he was in the clear, you know? He had the money. Sabrina, she was in the can. Whoops, too bad for Sabrina, but gotta get on with your life, you know what I'm saying? So once Kevin was arrested, Sabrina agreed to testify for a reduced sentence. Kevin was charged with conspiracy to commit aggravated murder and sexual battery relating to Sabrina. Now, the entire trial was based around Sabrina. You know, she never would have murdered without being manipulated by Kevin. She was bewitched by him, which is kind of funny because of her name. No, just me. Kevin denied everything because, of course, he did. Kevin Knafel didn't know anything. While all this was coming out, many, many family and friends, they were absolutely shocked. They never thought there was anything at all inappropriate going on between Kevin and Sabrina. But that trial, a few people did come forward saying they saw not anything outright, but like maybe small hints that this was not the father-daughter relationship it was supposed to be. The cell phone activity showed Kevin had been texting Sabrina a hell of a lot more than he was texting his own wife, and that Kevin was desperate to visit Sabrina in prison just days after she murdered his wife. The real punch, though, against Kevin's defense was a friend of Sabrina's named Autumn Pavlik. See, the problem with the case was, as you're hearing, it's a whole lot of he said, she said. And they were relying on Sabrina's word for most of it, her testimony against Kevin. But she was also the word of a killer, you know, saying she was manipulated into doing it without really a whole lot of evidence. Other than just Kevin simply being weird after the death of his wife, he apparently loved it just so much.
What was his relationship to you?
It was when a foster father wouldn't need it to be, and when a lover, when when not being a foster father.
Can you describe for us or give us an idea of exactly the statements that Mr. Knievel made to you about his wife being gone?
She would be worth more dead than alive.
That's what the defense was arguing anyway. Though from the other side, Kevin was a complete coward piece of shit who manipulated a teenager who was seemingly never given any attention by any parental figures ever. Seduced, manipulated, and then made to do his dirty work. So, remember I mentioned a hitman ploy that Sabrina said she and herself and Kevin had discussed? Well, Sabrina went to Autumn Pavlik, her friend, thinking that her friend Autumn was connected to a tough little gang of ruffians. Maybe she could find a killer for her. So Autumn and Sabrina talked about paying the hitman by delivering drugs for him, by doing working for the hitman to get him to kill, and then Kevin came on the phone.
There was a phone call that we had. She had asked me if I was able to get her a hitman.
Could you tell if there were any other people in the room at the time?
Yes.
And how could you tell that?
I could hear the defendant in the background talking.
And after the murder, Autumn went to the cops to tell them about this. And then she had a recorded conversation with Kevin after Lisa's death.
The only thing that I worried about is that whole hitman thing. I mean, I know she went off and did it by herself, but the whole hitman thing, I don't want to be sucked into it if she decides to open her mouth about it.
I honestly don't know. Like I said, you know, she talked a big game about a lot of things.
She also talked to him while wearing a hidden camera, but nothing really ever came of that.
You wanted the hitman to take care of Lisa, or whatever, because she was worth more dead than alive to you. And so I was curious, what do I tell him?
The defense, however, continued that there was no inappropriate relationship, and there wasn't much proof of it, they said, other than simply the word of Sabrina. And others, others who said maybe they saw something or saw a hint of something, heck, they never came forward earlier. Lisa, she was a social worker. She dealt with sex crimes. She dealt with troubled kids. She never saw anything, and she was someone who was experienced with it. Or at least, well, she never said anything. Kevin was innocent, the defense said. There was no manipulation. Sabrina just hated Lisa. However, Sabrina never changed her story. The jury took 10 hours to deliberate and convicted Kevin on all counts. He was sentenced to life in prison. At the sentencing, Lisa's ex-husband, the father of 13-year-old Megan, he spoke.
I sure hope that you think about what you did in jail. And I hope you rot in jail the rest of your life.
Lisa also received a life sentence, but she would be eligible for parole in 30 years. In February 2017, a judge awarded Lisa's two daughters, who witnessed the horrendous crime, $6.2 million in damages. Wow, what a batshit disturbing story that one is. And what a coward. What a fucking coward Kevin is, like manipulating a teenager into murdering his wife for him. He's also a predator, so he's got that going for him. This kind of leaves me sick to my stomach, to be honest. I think we can finish up there now for this old one. Thank you so much. I really do appreciate you taking the time to be here with me, listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoyed it or found it interesting, because I really found it interesting telling you this whole story. And before we go, like I said, if you could please subscribe, follow, leave reviews and ratings, positive ones if you don't mind, that would help me out just so much, and I can't thank you enough if you do that. So cheers, and yeah. Here, I'll talk to you in a couple of days, and also YouTube videos where you'll hear me tell stories like the ones I just told, with videos and audio and all that sort of stuff. In fact, both of these stories I made videos about. This is a retelling of them, so you can check that out if you want to also. But as always, please take care of each other and take care of yourselves, because I love you. Mike out.